So we will start with a work session on Senate Bill 193.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 193 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 193 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I will defer any discussion because I don't believe I was here on the day we heard that bill. So, is there any discussion on the bill, on the motion, excuse me, on the motion? Hearing none, any objections? So ordered. Becker and Corcoran will be absent. And do you want to carry it?
I will carry the bill. Thank you.
Senator Gordley will carry the bill. Session is closed. We will then go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 187. Open the public hearing. Mr. Cutlin, you want to present the bill?
Eight, seven, raises costs.
Doesn't like going in reverse order. Got to see here the staff, what order the staff put, see my staff put the bills in the file afterwards. I'm going to be careful. I don't think they did. Mr. Putnam, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, banks are, and other financial institutions are now allowed to make reasonable charges when they provide financial records to people who ask for them. The rate, which is a maximum, I'll call it a prima facie rate, in the bill, was last changed in 1985. The changes are on your staff measure summary. They're going from $10 an hour to $30 an hour for personnel costs, reproduction costs from 10 cents a page to $1 a page, and travel costs from 20 cents a mile to 50 cents a mile. Again, the institutions are not required to charge that amount, and if they can demonstrate their actual costs were higher than that, they can do that too.
Okay. Sign up sheet for the bill?
Yes.
Tim Martinez and Sue Pioski.
Pioski.
I have Tusky. I missed one of the skis, I guess. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Martinez. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Oregon Bankers Association. She just said her name, so I'd be able to say it again. Joining me at the table is Sue Pioski, who's from the Bank of Astoria, where she serves as Vice President Manager for Operations. We appear for you today on Senate Bill 187 that was introduced by Lynn Hammond at our request, and as your committee administrator aptly summarized, it's our attempt to bring a request for financial records for cost of that in line with today's cost. ORS 192, 580, and 805 right now set out how financial institutions recover those costs prior to disclosing the financial records requested by summons, subpoena, search warrant, or customer authorization. You've heard some of the costs that are covered. Currently, the statute, the way it's laid out, they are safe harbor numbers, so that if you charge that or less, it's deemed to be a reasonable cost and they cannot be challenged in court. What we're asking is that the safe harbor level be raised to $30 for the personnel cost per hour, $1 per page on copying, and then 50 cents per mile on travel expenditures. These have not been raised since 1985. Attorneys are challenging more and more financial institutions around the state when costs are above those. In fact, in visiting with, if I can call her Sue, we discovered that most banks around the state are in the $20 to $30 range now, and frankly are at up to $2 a page for copying. So we think these are reasonable increases at this point. Sue is going to talk a little bit about a problem she incurred, her institution incurred, with an attorney over in Astoria. I would add that this bill currently makes no change to the exemption that prosecutors receive from paying costs covered such crimes of negotiating a bad check, forgery, theft by deception, or fraudulent use of a credit card. I can't help but note that the district attorneys are represented here today, and in a brief across-the-room conversation, they're concerned that these increases could harm their ability to pursue all types of cases up to and including murder. So I'll let them address that. I had not heard of that before today. Also, I understand there are some potential costs to state agencies because they're included in this, and I believe there's somebody here from DCBS to discuss that as well. I guess I would just answer both of those concerns that we're certainly open to negotiation or to talk about the prices. We think they're fair prices before you and reasonable, again, since they haven't been changed since 1985, and would leave it to the committee to instruct us on how to proceed on that. I'd now like to turn over to Sue, kind of her horror story, which, as I say, are more and more common in this area.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sue Piaskowski. I work at Bank of Astoria in Astoria, Oregon. Bank of Astoria is a small community bank. We have about $125 million in assets. The Bank of Astoria, we actually don't have a research department. We have a bookkeeper, and our bookkeeper does many other duties, and researches is one of the things that she does. So when it comes to requests, subpoenas, we try to see if we can get the request down to as minimal as possible so that we can save costs for not only the person requesting the information, but our bookkeeper. We've determined that that at Bank of Astoria, I guess we're kind of in the dark ages with research. It takes about an hour to find 6 checks on microfilm, and that takes a number of different steps that the bookkeeper has to go through to be able to actually get to those checks, and that's why it's approximately 6 checks per hour. I wanted to explain that to you because then you'll be able to understand, I think, what we go through when we are asked for research. Last year, the Bank of Astoria was involved in a dispute regarding research fees, and that dispute lasted almost 6 months. We received in 1999, December, a subpoena from an attorney asking for records on a number of our clients. They were a family. And his subpoena actually said he wanted any and all records to these people's accounts from 1983 to 1999. And that first I had to determine how many accounts there were. At that point, I always call the person that has issued the subpoena so that we could talk about how we can reduce costs and maybe zero in on something specific. All records, checks written, deposits made from 1983 to 1999 is really broad, and it's amazing how many requests we get. After talking to the attorney, most often we can zero in on what we need. At that point, there was the subpoena was quashed, and we didn't get back through many different circumstances. We didn't get back involved with it until March. In March of that time, I advised the attorney that there were 16 accounts for these people, and could he maybe narrow it down because of costs? Where we could begin. Through much discussion, he decided to begin with one account, and he decided to go from 1983 to 1999. So to begin with, before we can even do any of the research, we have to find the statements that are from that person's account for those number of times that they want us to find the checks. In this case, these are the statements for 5 years of these people. And it's one account. On the one account, there were 842 checks written with an estimated time of 6 checks per hour. It would have taken us 140 hours to pull the checks for him. It would have cost $2,800. And at that point, I had made an agreement with him that I would charge $20 an hour, but I would reduce the $1 copy fee to 10 cents for him, since he was quite insistent that he needed this. So when I wrote him that it was $2,800, he said absolutely not. And this was in March, and that's when it basically began, to the point that our attorney was involved with him, and we went nowhere after he protested the fees for probably a number of weeks. At that point, we heard nothing, and then in June, he came back to us and said, well, he didn't really need this, but what he wanted was records for 5 years on another account of the person that we were pulling the records for. So we went ahead and got the research for that other account. And at that point, that other account, though, they, in the 5 years, they wrote 1,389 checks, and would have taken 232 hours for us to produce, and it was a cost of $4,917. We had our legal counsel write him a letter telling him what the costs were, and that was the last we heard from this attorney. And we have since found out that the case has reached agreement, and he was able to come to an end result without any of the records that he requested.
Okay. Questions?
These numbers, Tim, how do you get these numbers? First of all, what do you pay your bookkeeper?
Our bookkeeper, she has been with us for a number of years. She's being paid about $12 an hour.
$12 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The overall numbers, where do you get 30? Where do you get a buck? Where do you get 50 cents?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, again, these are safe harbor numbers. So one of the things we're trying to do is avoid having to come back here every 2 years. We haven't been back to see these numbers change since 1985. What we did do in this case is kind of survey other banks around the state to see where they were at. And the typical bank in Oregon right now is charging somewhere between $20 and $30 an hour, is charging up to $2 a page for copying, and the travel expenses really weren't something that we looked at from any kind of formal survey, because they're generally not one that we use a lot. So that's where we came up that we'd put the limit at this point, or the safe harbor limit at this point, at $30 and a dollar a page, because frankly the personnel costs are the greater of any of these.
Any other questions?
Yeah, that's $12 an hour instead of 30. I guess using the rule of 72, though, roughly I can only get about a doubling of these things since 85. Using that methodology.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, you're correct that there's only a $12 cost for the bookkeeper. There's also a cost that Sue incurs for her time, because she gets them first and forwards them on to the bookkeeper. And the example she gave, they went not only to the CEO, but also to their outside counsel. And it's my understanding that the copies she's shown you today were never paid for. So that, you have to factor that in as well, that wouldn't be included in a typical one that there is recovery. These costs are laid out in advance. There's generally nothing done until the costs are agreed upon, but I think what you'll find is Bank of Astoria is not unique, that they'll begin the process and try to see what you're looking at before they begin, before they collect any money. So again, I think you're absolutely right that if you can say the costs have only doubled since 1985, I won't argue that point, but again, we don't want to come back 2 or 4 years from now. We'd like these to be in place for a while.
So if we pass it this time, we won't see it for another 16 years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, even with term limits, I promise you won't see us before any of you are term limited out.
That would be 8.
And I, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I would just add that I think it is a key piece that the costs are known up front. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is to see if you can narrow down the search. Frequently all these are in in civil cases where one family member is suing another. And when they discover the cost, it turns out they didn't need it all the way from 83 to 99. They needed it for 96 to 98. Which brings up the second point is then it's a privacy issue. You know, should anybody have access to all these records when they're really looking on looking for a specific piece of the puzzle?
Thank you.
Tim, is this a typical story from the Bank of Astoria, or is this kind of the worst case scenario?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't believe it's the worst case. It's happening more and more around the state, especially in a community bank or a community credit union. They don't have folks, kind of like garnishment, they don't have folks that sit around doing garnishments all day. It's part of their job. So it is becoming more and more typical, unfortunately.
Okay. And let's be very clear, this doesn't say that these are the rates that would be charged. This is up to that amount before they have to worry about being challenged.
Mr. Chairman, members, that's correct.
And so these charges are, in the case of the Bank of Astoria, mm-hmm. if we were to pass this bill as drafted, would your rates automatically go to this amount and then, or would they become negotiable up to this amount?
Our rate right now is $20 per hour, $2 per copy. I think that rate would stay the same and then give us the leeway that if it became more, we could go up to 30.
We've been charging rates over the legal time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Dale Penn and Meg Reinhold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney Association. This is a statute when I started prosecuting in 1976 didn't exist, and for years people in.
Did you say 1986?
76.
Oh, 76. Okay.
Evidently, it didn't exist. If it began in 85, I couldn't look up ORS right now to see. But for a number of years, people in DA's offices really weren't aware of it, and I think initially most banks didn't utilize this in criminal cases. I certainly am sympathetic to the story that has been presented, and I expect that it has been misused in some situations by civil lawyers. The problem that I present to you is that finances are a very difficult issue in the investigation of crime. As you know, the state years ago was to be responsible for witness fees for prosecutors. And yet, over the years, that has diminished to the point that we continue to lobby today that the state's participation and payment of expenses for prosecution should be higher. It is now at 9% of our costs. We do not receive even 50% of the witness fees that we must pay out. And I've got to say that those witness fees are $5 a day, 8 cents a mile by statute. So we aren't paying witnesses very much money to come in and testify in criminal cases. Unfortunately, I did become aware of this statute and a number of years ago, and this effort to put in an exemption for criminal cases did take place, but it only applies in basically check kinds of cases. So forgeries, theft by deception by a check, or fraudulent use of a credit card and negotiating a bad check. So in those situations, we would issue, or the grand jury might issue a subpoena, typically in those kinds of cases, and we would always work with the institution we're dealing with. But banks are the only institution that have this special statute that allow them to charge dollars above statutory witness fees. So doctors don't have this capability, schools, all the other professions, banks only have this capability. I must tell you that today, with this statute, there are cases that we do not prosecute simply because of the cost involved in trying to investigate them. And that is what concerns me about this bill. If there was some way to expand the exemption to crimes like official misconduct, major crimes of violence, we would not back away from a murder case. I use that as an example where we would certainly always ask, what is the cost? How can we narrow this? But we wouldn't back away from a murder case. But I will tell you that any other case we would back away from just because of cost. My county is the fifth largest county in this state. We prosecute about the second or third highest amount of cases in the state. We're far behind Multnomah County. But in my office, a rather large office, my total budget for a year for all expertise or investigative costs is $15,000. So if we're going to bring in psychiatrists, psychologists, all any type of expert witness, or pay for financial records in a case, I have $15,000 for the entire year. We prosecute about 10,000 criminal cases, adult and juvenile, a year. We do about 15 to 20 murder cases a year, unfortunately, in this county. And so the difficulty that we have is there will be cases that we will have to back away from. I expect that what will happen with the raising of these limits is the bill that I will receive, or as we try to negotiate those amounts, it's going to be closer to $30 an hour than it is $10 an hour. And so I just bring this issue to you. I will be in Ways and Means, and I know Senator Gordley has heard me make these speeches in past sessions in Ways and Means about the need for resource and the need for witness costs. And I am sympathetic to the situation of the banks. I guess I would ask that if this expansion is going to occur, that perhaps we add some of the most important cases to the state of Oregon as part of this exemption, and perhaps in the other ones we could deal with these costs. But that's the problem I present to you. I apologize. I just learned of this bill. We don't normally track bills outside of judiciary, and so I just learned of this bill this morning, and so that I haven't had a chance to really talk to people about it. But that's the problem we face, and appreciate your time.
Senator Gordley?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Attorney Tim. Good to see you. I do want to seek a clarification about something I believe you said, that there are cases you do not prosecute now because of the cost of prosecuting. Is that accurate?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, yes, there are a number in my county. It's easiest to talk about. We routinely will, we've gotten into some narcotics cases, felonies, and a large number of misdemeanors. In this kind of situation, the first question I would ask in an official misconduct investigation that would be brought to our office by a police agency is, all right, What are we going to do about paying for these financial records? Is your agency going to pay for this? If you're expecting my agency, what is the cost? And that's exactly the situation I see happening. And there have been times, just because of the cost of financial records, that we would back away from the investigation and say, this is going to have to be handled civilly or someone else.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, just to get more definitive about how many times this has happened. Is it two cases or more? Have you tracked how many times you've not gone forward with the prosecution because of these kinds of costs?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, no, I have not, and I can only respond in the way that I've told you. I can tell you that in my county, by budget policy, we do not prosecute about 2,000 misdemeanor cases each year and about 250 narcotics cases per year, just by budget policy. I have had that conversation that I've discussed about the finances and the investigative costs a number of times. How many I couldn't tell you, but I just try to highlight that would be the issue that I would see repeated statewide, county by county.
And if I may ask another follow-up, you are a member of the District Attorneys Association, the statewide association.
Yes.
And I know you're not here representing them today, but could you kind of venture a comment on how you think the association might look at this policy?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, I am representing the association in opposition and just raising this issue of cost, and suggesting that maybe a way to deal with that, as I've talked to a few people throughout the state, is maybe expanding some of the crimes that would be exempted, or I don't know what else to propose, but the cost factor is our only concern.
Thank you.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's kind of what I was looking at. One idea is to exempt further crimes. Would you expect the material to be provided for free, or would you pay cost or negotiate, or just what do you think would be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, what we've always tried to do, and we wouldn't have a problem with, maybe this is a suggestion, leaving these charges in for criminal cases. As I've said, there are times we have to back away, but that would be much preferable to saying let's extend it three times to $30 an hour, and maybe that would allow the recovery of costs. Typically, we would always want to work with the people in our community, and so we do that now with hospitals and doctor's offices, and I know that they charge a lot of money to civil lawyers in cases, getting medical records and that type of thing. They usually try to work with us really well, because we're talking about violent crime usually, for medical records, and I expect that we can work with the financial institutions. It's just this expansion, I think, is going to be very difficult for us.
But I want to make sure I'm clear what you said, that currently there are 2,000 misdemeanor cases and 2,500 or 250 narcotic cases approximately per year in your county that you're not prosecuting because of cost.
Yeah.
How much of that is attributed to this cost?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm not saying that it's attributed to this. I just simply illustrate the situation of resources. And I guess it's complicated because we receive a little bit of money from the state and mostly from the county, and those resources haven't been enough for us to do all the cases in our county. This is an exacerbation of that. It certainly is not the cause, or a 50% share or anything like that. I simply say there have been times I can think back where I've said we need to back away from this investigation just because of the cost of finances.
Okay. Thanks. Meg?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Meg Reinhold. I'm here representing the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm in the Director's Office. As part of our department, we have the Division of Finance and Securities, Corporate Securities, and we regulate securities industry as well as a bunch of other smaller programs, including the mortgage brokers. We're here today because we've made a promise to Senator Harper and others that we don't want to raise fees. And what this bill would do is sort of make that a little closer to reality. We, as part of our regulation, we investigate fraud and other misbehaviors, and sometimes that means we subpoena records from financial institutions. If you estimated a tenfold increase, it's hard to tell because different banks do charge different rates, but we would go, it would be a $50,000 to $60,000 impact in our securities division, and another $10,000 for our mortgage brokers. Securities department is a bigger division, but the mortgage brokers is a smaller division. So that impact would certainly increase.
Okay, we don't have a fiscal statement on this bill yet. The number you just gave us, is that what's going to be on the fiscal?
I can't promise that. Our guys, we haven't calculated it out yet. We're not sure. Not yet. though. The difficulty we have is that different banks charge different things, so you can't just take what we've been paying and multiply it by 10 or, you know, that's, so we have to really kind of calculate it out to a better number.
So, Mr. Chairman, Department of Justice has been working on, not Department of Justice, Legislative Fiscal has been working on this. They said there will be a fiscal impact statement. As of now, the only numbers they have are from the Department of Justice, who believe they will be minimal. And theirs is mostly, according to the statement in the investigation of Medicare fraud. We don't have any numbers from DCBS, nor from child support, nor from revenue. And I hear the numbers going up.
I really apologize for not having the fiscal impact. This is not something we, you know, normally do, is show up without good numbers, but we can get those to you real quickly.
Well, I think
I didn't mean to say that critically. I just meant it to imply that we don't have a complete record yet.
Well, I think obviously we aren't going anywhere until we get a fiscal from Legislative Fiscal Office, so don't worry about getting those numbers to us. Get them
there. Right.
You sounded pretty critical to me.
Any other questions? Guess not. Dale, is this something that you anticipate? I mean, what kind of a fiscal number do you anticipate that the counties are going to put on this?
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I don't think that there will be a fiscal impact from the counties. That isn't ordinarily a state cost, even though the witness fees for state prosecution is a state cost. We haven't been asked for a fiscal. That's why I was late in even knowing about this hearing. I will go back and try to see if we can get one into LFO, because I think that would be helpful.
Well, I would think that there'd be an unfunded mandate situation coming up if there is an additional cost to local governments.
Mr. Chairman, there's a wrinkle in that, too, and that unfunded mandate business does not apply in certain cases of criminal prosecution, so it's an additional factor.
Okay. Senator Harper?
Is it feasible to frame this thing so you have two different sets of costs? You know, the government, DA, has a different... we do it to some extent now, I guess.
I think... I'm going to ask Mr. Martinez to work with the district attorneys and with the department and see if there's a way that the fiscal problem of this could be addressed, short of sending it to Ways and Means and having them come up with the money, because I don't think the sponsors of the bill want to take their chances with what's going on down there.
Yeah, how do you stop abuses and then still have them?
Thank you very much.
So, once you guys get together and see if there's anything that you can work out on it. Otherwise, we'll wait until we get a fiscal on it and then see what has to happen after that. Okay? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 187. Now, what we've all been waiting for. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 440.
Well, that name is for me. Yes.
Okay. You want to present the bill, Mr. Putnam?
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 440, let me get my act together here, is an attempt to clarify the law following a court ruling where, well, the prior history was the director of the insurance division believed that a requirement about substantial equivalency of coverage related only to purely fire insurance policies, but the court has ruled that any policy, like a broad form homeowner's policy that included protection against fire losses, also has to have these disclosures about the size of the pipe and I believe also where the disclosure has to be in the policy. I do have an amendment that was put in at the request of the insurance division And I have that pending gross amendment. Oh, you already have it?
We have that, but we don't have the actual...
Oh, yeah, the conceptual.
We don't have the actual amendment.
I've got the real thing in the possession of the committee here somewhere.
Okay. Mr. Powell, you want to...
And it's the same as your conceptual.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is John Powell, appearing before you today representing CGU North Pacific Insurance Company and State Farm Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, appearing with me are two attorneys. To your right, my left, is Tom Crist, is an attorney with the firm of Mitchell, Lang, and Smith in Portland, and he specializes in appellate law, and he has helped us research this issue over the past year. And to my right is Tom Mortland, who is in charge of claims for CGU North Pacific with offices in Portland.
We've got a one-attorney limit, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, that loud ticking noise you hear is not your hearing aid, it is the clocks. To my left and right. No, I'm just kidding. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this the case that your staff has outlined for you was an important case in and of itself, but the ramifications of the Fleming decision go far beyond that case, and I think that's the most important thing to remember, is that it wasn't purely a dispute between this insurer and their insured. While that was important and the facts of that case were important, this decision affects all insurance policies that cover property and perhaps even more. And therein lies at least our dilemma. Is, as your staff pointed out, the court applied a section of statute to multi-line policies that is incongruent and really doesn't work very well for anyone, and particularly consumers. The bottom line in any insurance product is you have to know the risk in order to resolve claims or to know what to charge for premium. It's like the old story of the guy went to a life insurance salesman and said, I want life insurance. And the salesman said, fine, we have that. He said, well, how much do you want? And the guy says, I don't know, I'll tell you when I die. Can't buy it that way. You've got to know up front what is the risk and to what extent are you going to take claims.
Is that a joke?
I laughed.
And they're on the clock? Oh.
The other thing that the committee, I think, has to understand before we get to the actual situation involving the case is just a very brief primer in the history of fire insurance. And with that, you may need to put toothpicks in your eyelids to hold them open. But actually, it is kind of interesting. Oregon, like most states, standardized fire insurance at the turn of the century, in the case of Oregon in 1907. It actually adopted basically 165-line policy in the statute. That remains today. It's archaic, it's not used, but it's still there. And I think it was based on the New York statute. So most states standardized it. That was modified in 1911 and in 1945, but only in terms of some technicalities. And then in 1967, the legislature authorized insurance companies to write insurance policies that included the peril of fire, but also other things, other perils of a more all-risk type policy. That's where the confusion comes in, because when that statute was created, it was assumed that the standard fire insurance policy over here, with all of the section that regulates that standard insurance fire policy, would remain as a unit to be interpreted as such. What the case of Fleming brought was the court, in this case, the state Supreme Court, not following the advice of a circuit court, not following the advice of the Court of Appeals, because they held differently. State Supreme Court reached over and applied to these multi-peril policies a standard that was written for this standardized insurance policy. So that that is where the rub comes in. And the statute that surrounds the standard fire insurance policy, because it was standardized, because it was statutory, it was very easy to understand why the legislature back in 1907, 1911, and 1945 said, okay, insurance companies, you can change this a little bit. As long as you do at least this much, you can change the words. But if you do, in 1907, they said it has to be in a different colored ink because everybody was issued the same policy. That changed over the years. In 1945, they said that's kind of tacky, that ink. You have to put a title in such big letters above here saying that it's been changed and that you may lose or coverages may be changed from the old standard fire insurance policy. Then in 67, when these new multi-peril policies were allowed to come into existence, they were different. They were not standardized in the statute like the old standard fire insurance policy. A whole new section of law, and the insurance commissioner came to the legislature and said, I'm recommending this for the benefit of policyholders in the state of Oregon. They can be written cheaper. It's easier to understand because things would be written and be modified for individual circumstances, and the legislature adopted that. Well, then comes the Fleming case, and this Fleming case was a situation in which a fellow that owned a rental house was the unfortunate victim of a criminal act. His renter turned the house into a meth lab. The fumes that escaped from the production in that house contaminated every corner of it. As a result, the house had to be totally decontaminated. And you may have read something about this whole process and how important it is to decontaminate a property like this, because you can actually, as I understand it, many of these fumes can lead to cancer. The owner of the house then filed a claim for insurance. One of the exclusions in that insurance policy was an exclusion for pollutants. And so when the claim was denied, Mr. Fleming took this case to court, and the circuit court said, no, this policy is very, very clear. It excludes that right here on this line. Anybody can read that. It's not ambiguous, and it's very clear. So they appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals looked at the case, and they said, no, this search court's right. This thing is clear as can be. It's easy to read, easy to understand. The Supreme Court took the case and looked at it and said, well, yeah, that's true. But this argument that the lawyer threw into the batch of reasons why was a reference to this old standard fire insurance policy, which said, if there's any reduction in benefit, you got to have a title up there above that section. And because in these multi-peril policies, you don't put those in there, they basically then held that all of the exclusions in these policies are null and void. And the court reasoned the only remedy in this case is to read the policies as if these exclusions do not exist. So as we sit here today, a couple things have happened. We started preparing this in case there was a special session because there was a lot of scrambling going on in the insurance industry. We didn't know whether the markets were going to dry up, whether carriers would pull out. Thanks to the work at the insurance division and at DCBS, they really worked overtime to get insurers to settle down and to refile their forms. So most insurers have refiled their forms, and the way they've handled the situation is on almost every page in their new form, there is a warning above every section that you may lose coverage. Read carefully below. The problem with that as an ultimate solution to this case is those have not been litigated. And Mr. Chris could speak to this much better than I could, but there are perils even with that warning, because the statute says explanatory statement. What does that mean? The court could say, well, it doesn't explain anything. You just said you might lose something down below. So we had Mr. Crist do an extensive research, some of which is responsible for what I've just told you, to look at how could this best be resolved for everybody involved, the consumer and the sellers of insurance. And that is Senate Bill 440, which is before you today, that we propose as the solution. And we do concur with the Dash 1 amendments that the insurance division has proposed. And in that bill, it would simply put the status of the law back to where everybody, including the insurance commissioner, believed it was prior to the Fleming case. And that is, that technicality in which this case was decided would apply, and that section would apply only to the standard fire insurance policy, which is still in the statute. Multi-peril policies would not have that section apply. And that's done by adding a reference in line 7 of the printed bill to RS 742-246. A copy of that statute is attached to the handout that I gave you and is highlighted in yellow. It's also accomplished in Section 2 by, again, a reference to the section the court used to find this case, that this section, and it says, and I quote, this section applies only to standard fire insurance policies described in ORS 742-202 and does not apply to any other insurance policies. So, again, making it clear for everyone involved as to what the status of the law is in this particular situation. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, if you would like, I think it best at this point to stop and see what questions you might have. We can lead you through the statutory references, again, that I did provide you at the back of this with highlights, if you have questions about how the interplay of these statutes interact. As well, I do have a copy for you of the amicus brief of the Insurance Commission that was filed asking the court to reconsider this case. I didn't hand it in with the other packet because I failed to put any note that who it came from. And your staff has already caught some spelling errors of mine, and I thought maybe it would throw a gavel if I introduced something without names on it. You will also notice that what was handed in to you has the names of a group of insurance representatives that have worked on this legislation in preparing for today. And we decided to consolidate for time purposes our testimony. With that, I would stop and answer any questions with the help of the certified witnesses beside me.
Thank you. Any questions? You sufficiently answered all questions. John, wouldn't another remedy be to delete the standard insurance, fire insurance language? It's archaic.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the solutions we thought of was not that bold, but we thought of just deleting the section that caused the problem, or a 742-246, which the court lineup. But we didn't want to do that for fear of people not understanding the fact that there would still be consumer protection in the law in this regard. In fact, the insurance division amendment that's before you in the Dash 1 amendments is a reference to an existing law that all policy forms that are used in Oregon must first be approved for use by the department. One of the tasks they have is administering a section of law that is provided for you in 742-005, which is grounds for disapproval of forms. And one of the things the director is responsible for is to make sure that the descriptions and contents of policies, titles, headings, backings, and other indications of the policy provisions are intelligible, certain, and not ambiguous. So that protection remains, and that reference takes its place. So the reason we didn't do something like that was, again, we didn't want people to think that there was a removal of protection. But yes, that could be a potential solution.
For further comments or questions for Mr. Powell or the other two gentlemen?
The only question I'd have, Madam Chair, is was there any opposition to this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, that's an excellent question. Not that we know of. Again, this, we're not challenging the Fleming case itself. It is simply to get back to the fact that there must be a framework in which insurers know what they're covering. And again, we think this is the best way to do that with the least dislocation of the statutes.
No, not yet. Is there anybody from the department wants to talk about it?
It's a great name.
Guess not. Thank you for bringing this forward. Close the public hearing. Open work session on Senate Bill 440.
I can make one. Great.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 440.
Senator Gordley moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 440. Discussion on the motion. Objections? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 440 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 440 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Objections? So ordered. Anyone volunteer to carry it? Senator Corcoran, you want it?
I'd be honored, Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I can confuse it with the best of them. I'm not even an attorney.
Okay, Senator Corcoran will carry the bill.
You've lit a fire under my week. Thank you for doing that.
Well, we expect to have a little more...
My heart soars like an eagle, Mr. Chair.
A little more animated discussion than what Senator Atkinson...
I'm enthralled. Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Those words.
Anything for Mr. Powell.
We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 441. Mr. Powell and Ms. Putman, you want to present the bill while we're waiting for them to come forward? So you got rid of your high-priced attorney.
Yes.
Yes, I got three copies of it.
Mr. Chairman, this bill needs tweaking, as I understand it. What it basically does is allows an insurer to use part of a driving record that otherwise insurers can't use, but it lets them use it if it's solely for the purpose of giving a premium discount.
Okay. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Come before you in support of Senate Bill 441 with the dash one amendments and some amendments that have not been printed yet. Today, Ms. Taylor and I had a discussion as to how the Department of Transportation reads this bill, because they do house the Department of Motor Vehicles, which does deal with the motor vehicle records. There is no problem per se with the bill, nor with the amendment that's before you. The only problem from their standpoint is some of the verbiage elsewhere in the bill that we have to go to legislative council and discuss. And because we just came to this agreement today, I would have had the bill delayed until then, but it was a little too late to do that. So I do appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, since for the last 20 years in Oregon, there has been a prohibition in the law against an insurer from using information from your driving record that is more than 3 years old. The reason for that prohibition was the fear that insurance companies would rewrite a book of business, something using entries that were older than that and thus not subject to people who have changed and straightened up their driving habits. Senate Bill 441 does not change that consumer protection. Insurers can currently get abstracts of your driving record that show many more years worth of entries. They just can't use it. State Farm did not believe this bill was necessary, and perhaps if litigated, they would be proven to be right. We don't want to do that. The insurance division has accepted a filing from State Farm under their current book of business that allows them to look back 5 years for the purpose of granting a discount. They have for current drivers, if you are claimed for 5 years, they have their absolute lowest rate. That's been approved because that's for existing customers. When State Farm then filed to allow that same discount to be applied for applicants, new applicants, they said, no, you're running into this statute. Thus, the Dash 1 amendment, which says that the bar on that does not apply if you're using more than 3 years for the purpose of providing a discount. So we think that this bill continues the consumer protection that the original bill brought 20 years ago and allows for an even more competitive insurance market in the auto field. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would stop and answer any questions. I did ask Kelly Taylor, representing DOT, to be here if you wanted anything from her as well.
Okay, I guess you said there's something else in the bill that you need to work on. Obviously, that wasn't something that's been amended by this bill originally. So,
and Mr. Chairman, as I understand what the department would like to do is just take out the references besides the Dash 1 amendment. That is, to delete the new language everywhere else in the bill, and because they see it as confusing. As I said in my introductory remarks, insurers can already get these records, so we don't need any other authority. And I believe what legislative counsel was trying to do, and this is a very complex area of the law to write, so it's not their fault. It's simply, I think what they were trying to do is make sure the whole thing flowed, because they don't deal in this every day, and I don't think they were aware that we could already get access to these records. So we don't need any authority to see them. And I don't want to speak for Ms. Taylor, but as she explained to me, that's what I understood their concern to be, is that this kind of is duplicative and would lead people not to understand the statutes as well as they could.
So specifically, you need to delete sub 5 of Section 3 and then any renumbering after.
And I think
that,
there's a, on the first page of the bill, line 19, there's a reference to the individual's non-employment driving record.
Okay.
So we will, with your permission, meet with legislative counsel and explain why that has to have amendments done just as soon as we possibly can get them back to you. And I don't blame the DOT for just getting around to finding all this stuff, because I can't get around to everything I'm supposed to be doing either. If you've seen those health insurance bills coming out the last few days, I'll never probably get around to them.
And I'm not very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do they charge you for making that record search?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper.
That's a serious question.
No, I understand.
Going to combine bills here?
Kelly Taylor probably could give you a better idea, and I think it's based on the length of the record. But a lot of money changes hands with the DMV from insurers for this.
Kind of looking for numbers, personally.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, the record today is $1.50 for each one.
That's per page?
Per record. Total.
Somebody's getting stiff here. Either the banks or ODOT, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as I recall, they used to charge more.
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, let me explain. With records, the way it is in statute is it is simply a cost recovery mechanism. There's no profit to be made off of records, but we also can't use highway fund dollars to provide them. So it's what we do is every a few years go through and assess the records, the volumes, the work associated with it, and establish the fees. And they're in admin rule and then put in bill form for you all to approve. And so currently, the driving record that the insurance companies request is $1.50.
How many pages is it? Is that just a computer email that goes someplace, or?
Mr. Chair, it's a computer printout. It's an automated process. And, you know, it's, you know, if they ask for the three-year record, it's limited to whatever, however many entries you have on a three-year record. For most people, probably, that they're insuring, it's probably a pretty short record, because if it got a lot of pages, it'd be another insurance company that'd be helping them.
So if you were to ask for my record, who, let me make sure this is accurate, I have no tickets or no accidents in the last 3 years, there would be nothing on it?
Mr. Chair, it'd be a piece of paper that would have just your pertinent information identifying that it is your record, you know, probably your name and your driver's license number, perhaps your address, and the fact that there are no entries on it, correct?
Mr. Chairman, there might be an exception to that. It was explained to me that if you'd done certain things that are real bad while driving, it might
become a legislator?
Like, yeah, right. I know we banned that. Actually, a bill did pass guaranteeing that elected official could not be discriminated against.
I remember that was 97.
Yeah. We've lost money ever since, Mr. Chairman. I don't know what the problem is.
Senator Corcoran.
I don't know if this is germane or not, Kelly, but there's another bill wending its way through that has to do with looking at for CDLs at the non-employment driving record. Are you familiar with that bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, I am.
Do these two intersect at all? Is there any difficulty with
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, there's no problem at all. They don't conflict with each other in the least. We maintain by statute both employment entries and non-employment entries, and the bill you're referring to is simply requiring employers to look. They're today, both by federal regulations, required to pull the employment entries for any prospective employees or on an annual basis the employees that they have. And what that bill is doing is asking them to look at the non-employment record also.
Right.
So we have it available for them, so it's not a problem.
Okay, I have no one, but Ms. Putnam, go ahead.
It's possible, I suppose, that in your conversations with legislative counsel, that you will not be making an amendment. They may convince you they need this language.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Putnam, that's correct. If they can convince us all may as shall as may.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. John, do you know of anyone who's...
No, I don't. And, Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank the committee members also for making time available to go over these bills. I know your time is valuable. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Close the public hearing, and we will schedule again, I guess, when we know if we need amendments or not. And that's all we've got, isn't it?
I've never had the
We're adjourned.
I've never heard of it.